are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, and this is Book Lovers Cafe. Book Lovers Cafe is a monthly program of author interviews and book reviews with a local perspective, and I'm your host, Chris Wilson. Today, we will be talking to American novelist and acclaimed short story writer, Rebecca Mackay. She has beaucoup star reviews, and you know what that means. She's also been in Best American Short Stories 4 years in a row, and she's just finishing a guest faculty position at the Iowa Writers' Workshop. Also, our listeners, especially those who listen to NPR and are familiar with This American Life, can actually hear Rebecca in a This American Life podcast read one of her short stories. Today, we will be reviewing her books, The Borrower, that was published in 2011, The 100-Year House, 2014, and a collection of really wonderful short stories, Music for Wartime, just published in 2015. Welcome, Rebecca. I'm so glad to have you here today.
Thank you.
So, Rebecca, you're from Chicago. Usually I interview people from the Pacific Northwest. So what brings you out here?
Yeah, so I'm going to be out there on Saturday, February 6th for the Port Townsend PT Shorts. Thank you. It's really going to be really fun. I'm going to get to sit back and hear an actor read my work. I don't have to get up there and do it myself. And that's something I've only experienced once before. I love that. Not just because I don't have to work. I love being on stage, but hearing someone else's inflections as they read. It's really fun.
Mm-hmm. So let's begin with The Borrower. I, as a former librarian and working with children, fell immediately head over heels in love with this story because your main character is a very young children's librarian. And can you tell us a little bit about her?
This is, she's a first-person character, an I character, although she's definitely not me. Since it was my first book, there was a lot of confusion out there as people reviewed it and really thought that the character was me. And the problem with that is she's a little bit unhinged. She does things that I really, as a person, don't approve of, that
no
I had
kidding.
To get behind to write the book. Right. So she's from a kind of a wealthy Russian immigrant family in Chicago, but she's living in Hannibal, Missouri, or a town that she says is not Hannibal, Missouri, but that she's going to refer to that way.
Mm-hmm.
And she's rather lonely and unsatisfied. And there's a 10-year-old boy named Ian Drake, who is her most regular, loyal patron. But Ian is being put, and I should say this all takes place, I think I had it set in 2002, Ian is being put by his parents into anti-gay therapy. They're conservative Christians, and at that point in time, there was a moment there historically where kids were being put into these gay conversion therapies, and fortunately some laws have been passed against that. But I was writing about a very real thing.
Mm-hmm.
Ian runs away one night to the library,
mm-hmm.
and when Lucy comes in the morning, she finds him. And he basically, it's complicated. He basically blackmails her into kidnapping him. Of course, she's sort of a willing participant in this and feels like she might be saving him from psychological harm. And they end up driving across the country. So you can see, the people assuming that I must have a lot in common with my main character, you're going, well, I wrote her, but I don't believe I would actually kidnap a child particularly.
I like the way that you base the story in reality. I mean, the story hour, the library sequences, the patrons, the people that work at the library all seem completely real and really fun to read about. And even the character of Ian, because I think that both school teachers, librarians, they form attachments to our patrons,
right,
and to certain kids that really seem to need the library and need school. And so, the reader gets hooked, and then, as I like to sort of phrase it, it goes off the rails. But for a while, you kind of think, well, okay, she'll drive around for a while and then she'll go back. But no, she does not. And also the fact that you work in the Patriot Act, All librarians know about that. And one of my colleagues, Ruth Hurlburt, up in Alaska, was one of the librarians that kind of got the ALA started on that. And yes, the push for parents to do something about their children who, you know, they thought might be gay. So when she's in Chicago, the reader begins to understand more about Lucy and her motivations. And here I'd like to talk about her background, that maybe it's not Ian that is really running away. She's got a...
Yeah.
Okay, so tell us about her background and if it relates to anything that you know about in your family in terms of legends and stories.
Right. So Lucy is the daughter of a Russian immigrant. He's sort of a fabulist. He tells stories about how he came to America, tells stories about setting off on adventures, you know. And she actually comes to realize throughout the book, after this visit with her father and in some subsequent encounters with some of his friends and phone calls back home, that the stories he's told about why he left Russia are completely false. He left Russia because he had possibly betrayed his brother in some pretty profound way. And he had betrayed his father, rather. Mm-hmm. He had betrayed his father in a pretty profound way. I was really having fun with this idea of the stories that were told versus the stories that we tell ourselves, mm-hmm. and how those might turn out to be not true, but maybe they're what we needed for survival. I originally wasn't going to write a story about a librarian. I had this idea of this boy, he was going to run away. And I thought about having him run to school. I thought of having him run to a neighbor. And when I settled on having him run to the library, that's when it became a book about stories and the way we tell stories to each other and to ourselves. So I felt like this idea of the family stories that this woman might have grown up with and discovering both how untrue and how essential they were would be a really interesting corollary. An interesting thing that happened, you know, my father is Hungarian and was a refugee after a failed revolution there in 1956. Mm-hmm. And so certainly there's this small part of, you know, I grew up thinking about, and I spent a lot of my adult life writing about refugees and immigrants because it's something I'm fascinated by. At the same time, I think a lot of readers realizing that about me would look at this Russian father and say, oh, well, her father's Hungarian, so same thing. She must be really writing about her father. And of course, you know, for my father, the Russians were the occupiers. They were, you know, as far from how he'd identify himself as possible. And so in my mind, making this father a Russian was not like just moving over a couple countries from Hungary. In my mind, it's a completely
really
different
right? It certainly is.
Culture and society and everything. I might as well have made in Chinese. But I think it contributed a little bit to this confusion of, oh, I must be really writing about myself. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think what you're getting at with the question about my own family is that there are four stories in Music for Wartime that are actually autobiographical, that are about my family history and my father's parents in Hungary. And I'm exploring a lot as I write, again, this question of what I've been told versus what's really true. I think it's something that I write about always, though. I think that, you know, my second novel, The 100-Year House, which has nothing to do with immigrants particularly, really is also about truth and reality, what we think we know versus what really happened.
That's true. I'm anxious, not anxious, but looking forward to reading more of your work and seeing what you discover about your grandmother, who was both a popular novelist in Hungary and Budapest and an actress. So she seems
right
to me a really fascinating character. I'm thinking about you in those 40 novels on your bookshelf, waiting to be translated, because it's a really interesting country. And, you know, it's been in the news a lot. You know, I'm thinking about you also writing about Syrian refugees and crossing the Hungarian border at some point.
Yeah. Well, what's really interesting is that my father, after 60 years in America, just moved back to Budapest.
Really?
This last spring. Yeah. And it wasn't something he ever thought he would do. His current wife is Hungarian. She had family back there. And although she's been here with him for decades, yeah, he decided that was where his life, you know, was going to end up. That was kind of a shock to my system, I think, this idea that, like so many first-generation Americans, I grew up with this huge mythology about how our family came to America, and here we are, and he just went and undid it, mm-hmm. which I'm grateful for in some ways. I think he's really happy there. I'm glad to hopefully soon have the chance to visit again. You know, in the process of trying to learn more about his mother, my grandmother, and as you said, she wrote 40 novels. I have them all, and I haven't been able to read them. I'm slowly learning Hungarian, but it's, as you might know, it is an extremely difficult language.
I do. I can say hello and goodbye and thank you when I visit.
Yeah, that's something. That's something. The grammar of it, it's not that it's terribly complex. It's just so different from our grammar.
Different. Yes.
It's unrelated. And the closest relatives to Hungarian are Finnish, and then after that, Korean.
Mm-hmm.
No kidding. So it's a strange language, but I'm working on it. And I just feel like there's a lot to unpack. And I do, you know, I wrote these pieces for Music for Wartime that were about her, about my grandmother, and about the rest of my family. But they were what I think of as overtly fictionalized nonfiction. They're basically stories where I'm saying, I don't know what happened. Here's what I've been told, and here's how I imagine it happened, mm-hmm. and basically turning it into fiction. But I think the next step for me.
Yeah, let's just talk about Music for Wartime for just a minute, because we're kind of there. And the fragment of the story about the woman who disguises the young girls, was that
right
with the makeup? So is that something mm-hmm. that you know that, you know, was passed down in your family, and then you made it into a short story?
Mm-hmm. That's it. I mean, I'm giving, you know, I'm not hiding the fact that this is my grandmother in that mm-hmm. story. It's the second of these. There's a fourth story that's different, but there are three stories that are subtitled Legend spread throughout the book. This is the second of them. I'm slowly revealing in that first story that this was my grandmother, but by the second story, people basically know. And I think a lot of people have read these stories, and they're so strange what her life was, that I get a lot of questions about, well, you made that up though, right? And I really didn't. She really did. You know, she'd been an actress. She had all this stage makeup, and she would... these young women would come to her to have their faces painted up with stage makeup so that they would look like old women. And, you know, whether it was to do work for the resistance or she was teaching them how to do it for themselves so they could go through the streets at night and honestly not be assaulted by soldiers. So, and my father stood there and watched this all happen. And I grew up with this story. It's a bizarre story to be told as a child. You know, your grandmother used to paint women's faces mm-hmm. to make them old so they wouldn't be raped in the street. And, you know, and I think the normal grandmother stories are like, your grandmother used to bake wonderful peanut butter cookies.
That's right. That's right. Well,
a different kind of grandmother.
You are listening to Book Lovers Cafe, and we are having a fascinating conversation with the author, Rebecca Mackay. She is the author of two novels, The Borrower, The 100-Year House, and a tremendous short story collection called Music for Wartime. Once again, this is KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, and we are talking to Rebecca Mackay. I'm your host, Chris Wilson. So let's talk about The 100-Year House. Right away, the title sounds like it's going to be a ghost story. And in a way it is, but not really. Is it the house
right.
that's haunting, or the house is haunted? I'd like to just read a blurb on the back of the book to help our listeners get in, have a little bit of understanding. This is written by B.A. Shapiro, the author of The Art Forger. A funny, sad, and delightful romp through the beginning, middle, and end of an artist colony, as well as the family mansion that sheltered it, and the family members who do and don't survive it. Told backward from the viewpoints of an array of eccentric and intertwined characters, the story's secrets are revealed with stunning acuity. An ambitious work, well realized. Sometimes when they say ambitious, then they say, but slightly flawed. No. I was just completely taken by this book. It is a wonderful read. It has you on the edge of your seat. It is funny. It is fascinating. And when you read it, you want to read it again because it is quite a puzzle. So Tell us about Laurel Field and how you began to write this book and created its very interesting structure.
Yeah, it started as a failed short story that had very little to do with the current story, except for the setting. And the setting that I was drawn to was sort of a big estate and also the coach house or carriage house, the little house out by the road, where at some point in time a chauffeur would have lived, but now would maybe be renters or a nanny or in-laws. And the short story I'd originally written kind of fell apart and fell away, and it was the setting that that stuck with me, that I was drawn to. I originally thought it was all going to take place in one time period, and these people who lived in this coach house were going to be researching the past, trying to figure out what happened in the 1920s when this place was an artist's colony, but that they would really never know the truth. And it was very unsatisfying. You know, real life is like that. We can't see what was happening in this building 100 years ago. But fiction, I finally realized, could take us back there, could actually do that. So I realized that we needed to leave the story starts in 1999. We leave that time period behind and we go back to 1955 when something kind of cataclysmic happened at the house. And then we go back to 1929 when the house was an artist's colony in full swing. And there's a poet who people have been trying all along to research. He's sort of a big mystery of the house. We meet him finally. And then at the very end, there's a brief, what I call a prologue, but it's at the end, just a few pages from 1900, right before the house was built. I found in that structure that I could let the readers know far more than the characters. The reader is the only one with all the keys to the puzzle. And I think that's a fun position to be in as a reader. Mm-hmm. You know, I think I wrote The Borrower because it was a story I really wanted to write. And I wrote The 100-Year House because it was a story I would have wanted to read.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, I kind of compare this book to a game, a puzzle. Some of your reviews have said it's like Clue, but I think it's more like tessellations falling into place. So as the people who love mysteries are going to love this book, but also it's definitely literary fiction, and it's got a lot of components. And I read that you did a lot of outlining and mapping. It seems like the house and grounds are so important. Is it an actual place, or did you invent it?
No, I invented it. It's based in small part, especially in its history, on artist colonies like Yaddo in upstate New York and Ragdale near Chicago. But it has a totally different history than those places, a totally different layout. And what I ended up doing, really, I'd been writing for a while and realized that I didn't have a clear map of the house in my mind. So I got out some huge butcher paper and I drew, it was 12 maps, because I had to do the top and bottom floor of both the big house and the coach house for all three of the major time periods, where the furniture was, who lived in what room, et cetera. And I still have them. You know, there's an official floor plan to Laurel Field. But it is a made-up place. I get a lot of dismay occasionally that the artists weren't real. We get back to the 20s. I think people are in some cases thinking that I'm talking about real people, and I'm not.
I knew that, but, you know, they're archetypes for real people. I mean, you can imagine
exactly.
The real people.
Yeah, there's an artist, there's a visual artist there in the 20s who has a lot in common with Georgia O'Keeffe, even though she isn't her.
Mm-hmm. There are key places where something significant happens at each time period. For example, the attic and the longhouse and, of course, the carriage house. When you were making this map, then did you also figure out what was going to happen there?
I did. I mean, in some cases I already knew, but I did feel like, there's a tremendous streak of magical realism going through the book. I'm not playing by the rules of the real world in this piece. And that's, evident right from the start. You know, the fact that certain things were always going to happen, in certain places, or that certain objects were going to recur, I'm not following the laws of probability. I'm making it happen. And I wanted certain things to echo and to repeat through each section. I wanted something significant to happen at this local college in each section that's there, and so on. There's a song that somebody's singing in 1929. It's a he's supposed to have composed. You know, it's a made-up song. Part of the chorus is history doesn't repeat, it merely rhymes. And that was my guiding aesthetic on a lot of that recurrence. Mm-hmm. I wanted those things to come up, and it really is that idea of this loaded object that we, you think about the, if you're familiar with the term of the Freudian uncanny, objects that just take on creepy significance or deeper meaning because of their recurrence, not because of anything that they do, just because they're there at the right moment.
Good. That helps me.
Yeah.
For example, the jade monkey. I mean, the jade monkey isn't kind of appears and disappears in different places.
It's not a symbol. You know, it doesn't mean anything. There's nothing to decode there. It's just that it is a through line. And mm-hmm. the more we see it, the creepier it becomes, you know, the more historical weight it takes on. So, and we know more about it than any character ever will.
Right. And so the rabbits and the two women called the white rabbits, you know, I kept thinking, she's seen the rabbits have appeared. Does that mean something's going to happen now?
right. But, yeah, it was really fun to plant those things. In each of the three sections, and this is totally like not something I'd expect people to notice, it's just me amusing myself, but in each of the three sections, I chose an object that is intended to, that historically is a symbol of luck, that there is a book very much about luck. But about the piling on of good or bad luck and how weird that seems after a while, how much it stops seeming like luck and starts seeming supernatural. In the first section, there's a plague of ladybugs.
Right.
There's these ladybugs.
It's not the happy ladybugs.
Right.
It's the ugly Japanese beetles.
Yes.
Right?
In the 1950s, it's rabbits. And in 1929, it's acorns. Acorns are falling early, pummeling the roof. You know, they're all three of those things are symbols of luck. You know, the rabbit's foot, the ladybug, and acorns are, I didn't assume people would know that acorns were symbols of luck. So someone actually says it in 1929. But, you know, these people are sort of besieged by luck, either good or bad, depending on the character and how much the house kind of seems to like them. It was fun to give certain people tremendous misfortune and fun to have things come together for other characters.
There's a lot of fun, again, in the book. We get to relive the craziness of Y2K.
right.
One of the characters is hiding the fact that in order to make money, he's hired himself out to write for a series somewhat like the Babysitter's Club. Those are pretty funny. And of course, the artists in the artist colony, they're just wild and they kind of reverberate with 60s hippies. And they seem to be permanently living at Laurel Field for as long as they possibly can. All of those characters are really enjoyable and fun. But yet, this story has some tragedy in it, too.
Yeah, there's a lot. There's actually a pretty high body count when you get to the end of the book, which is, it's funny because B.A. Shapiro so generously gave me that blurb and she uses the word romp. And on the one hand, I'll take it. And on the other hand, it's like, but there's a lot of dead people by the end.
That's right.
I'm not sure I would call it a romp. I'll take it.
But. Well, the thing is about your writing is that it is thrilling. It's mysterious. But yet you don't have to go into the writing, and I don't mean to knock other writers, but it's kind of sex scenes without long descriptions, no morbid body descriptions or murders, but yet it is chilling and a page turner. I mean, the plot is really important in your books, but there's a lot of other things to think about too.
Good, thanks.
So I want to talk about you and writers' residencies for you or artist colonies. Have these opportunities been important for you?
They have, yeah. I think I've done 7 artist colony stays. You know, they're tremendously valuable, I think, for everyone who's able to swing it. And I know, you know, there are a lot of artists who aren't. And I know writers who do things instead, like check themselves into the Holiday Inn for the weekend or send their kids to the grandparents' house and lock themselves in the bedroom with dried goods or however you can do it. That sort of intense, uninterrupted writing time. If you're trying to juggle all the elements of something as big as a novel, it's really important to have some purely uninterrupted time where you're not presented with other storylines by turning on the TV or by just having to go and cook dinner. It's certainly a luxury, and I'm absolutely spoiled getting to do these things. And I didn't always have these in my career. You know, when I wrote The Borrower, I was teaching elementary school full time. By the end, I also had a child and was pregnant by the time I finished this book. There was nothing like an artist colony anywhere in my life. So this is a luxury that's come about later in my career. You know, now that I do have two children, there's the added thing for me of having not only the time to focus, which obviously is going to be cut into by children, but the psychological space not to be someone's mother for a while. Mm-hmm. Certainly, you're always, you know, I'm always their mother, but no one's going to burst in the room crying.
Right.
No one's going to need me, you know, right now. And that means I can go into maybe a darker place in my mind, or, you know, forget about the real world for
or
a long time in a way that you can't if your kid is in the next room.
Right.
And the other thing about the colonies is the history is incredible. You know, I was at Yaddo recently, and I was writing in the same room where Sylvia Plath wrote her first collection of poetry. Mm. And how can you not be inspired by that?
That's true. I'd also like to ask you about the other fine arts, things like music and acting, drawing. Have those been helpful to you in your writing life, participating?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, you know, the story collection is called Music for Wartime. Not all of the stories involve music, although a great number of them do, are about musicians. Other ones, though, are about visual artists or actors or, you know, basically what that collection is doing is circling around the question of what does it mean to try to make art and make beauty and order in the midst of a brutal and chaotic world. And, you know, sometimes the wartime, the war zones are literal. Sometimes it's something like the set of a reality TV show. Sometimes the art is literal. I'm writing about a string quartet. Sometimes it's more, you know, I have a story about a professor of American literature, and her connection to the arts is slightly different. But yeah, no, I was raised in a very musical household. My sister is a musician. My parents were both linguistics professors, but very gifted musicians as well. It's really been my time at some of these artist colonies that's introduced me to the working life of visual artists, performing artists. And the theater's always been a part of my life as well. I studied a lot of theater in college, and have always been friends with a lot of actors, and always kind of secretly wished that I had become a playwright instead of a novelist.
Oh, there's time. There's time.
I think there might be.
I'd like to talk about maybe what's on your book shelf right now or beside your bed, and some short story authors that you found inspiring before we leave you.
Sure. Yeah, you know, the last three books I read were all books that were pre-publication, although one of them is out now, mm-hmm. all by friends of mine. So, you know, I was getting early copies to give a blurb for the back of the book. And I adored all three of them. The Lightkeepers by Abby Gini, which is out now, although it's done so well that they're completely out of stock everywhere. They have to print
really?
More books. That's a good sign,
that's
right?
That's good,
and,
yes.
A book called Bottomland by Michelle Hoover that's sort of a mystery set in Iowa at the end of World War I. It's just beautiful. That'll be out in a couple of months. And then I've just finished reading a debut novel by an author named Kim Brooks that's called The House Guest. It was right at my alley. It's about basically and it's so timely. It's about a refugee during World War II. A European Jewish refugee who's brought over. She's staying in these people's house as a guest, but there's something very bizarre about her, and everyone's trying to figure out what's wrong with her. Those last two are not even out yet, but you'll be seeing great things about those books really soon.
We'll be first on the list. I'd like to thank you again for joining us today, and we've been talking to Rebecca Mackay, a short story writer and novelist. Join me next time to talk more about books and authors. I'm your host, Chris Wilson, and I'd like to thank Larry Stein, Mike Schlexer, who's in the booth with me today, Nora Petrich, and all the volunteers and supporters who make this wonderful radio station possible. Keep reading. We'll see you next time.